You can see you have a lake.
Subcommittee on Redistricting, I'll call it to order. And today we have Mr. Bodern. He's going to give us a little of, a little legal lesson today, Mr. Bodern, on the Voting Rights Act and an overview of that. He's ready to rock with a PowerPoint even. So thank you, Mr. Bodern, for the work you put into this and for retrieving some quick language for Senator Ress, too. I'm sure we'll talk about that maybe after his presentation.
Sure, that'd be great.
Okay. Mr. Bodern.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Last time I had a hard time hearing myself because the fan on the projector here is sort of loud, so I'll try to speak up. And given the hour of the day, I will not go into a very extensive overview of how the Voting Rights Act has affected redistricting, but I put together a short presentation for you here. The place to begin is with the U.S. Constitution and amendments that were the 14th Amendment, which was ratified in 1868. It's the operative part of the language is shown here. And the important part is in the last part of the language, it says that no state shall make or enforce any law which shall abridge the privileges or immunities of citizens of the United States or deny equal protection. It must be read together with the 15th Amendment, and you'll note that was ratified a few years later, which is a little more direct. The right of the citizens of the United States to vote shall not be denied or abridged by the United States or by any state on account of race, color, or previous condition of servitude. Moving ahead.
Hang on, Mr. Bodern. Senator Rest has a question or a point.
Question. Is the word naturalized defined anywhere in the Constitution, or is it just a plain meaning from the dictionary? Do you know?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Rest, you're testing me here, but I don't believe it is defined in the Constitution. I'd have to double check that for you.
So it's just a plain meaning in the. It means the same thing everywhere. Naturalized means by some legal process you become a citizen of a country.
That's correct, and if you're referring to other parts of the Constitution, there may be similar language that might have a slightly different meaning. I'm not sure it's used that way throughout the Constitution, in other words.
I'm just curious.
Mr. Bodern.
So, the 15th Amendment was ratified in 1870. Moving ahead almost 100 years, it would be a gross understatement to say that enforcement of this particular provision in the Constitution was very difficult to accomplish, particularly in some areas of the United States. So that's kind of fast-forwarding you through to the passage of the Voting Rights Act of 1965. And we can take a look. There's some subsequent legislative history that has an important bearing on redistricting as well. In particular, the amendments that were made in 1982 in response to a United States Supreme Court opinion that basically required an intent to discriminate before it would consider changes to a redistricting plan. Congressional amendments made it clear that a discriminatory effect would be sufficient to sustain a challenge to a redistricting plan under the Voting Rights Act. There are two major portions of the Voting Rights Act, Sections 2 and 5. Section 2 is the one that applies nationwide to all jurisdictions and allows a challenge to all manner of election laws, but specifically for our purposes today, redistricting laws. It's no voting qualification or prerequisite to voting or standard practice or procedure, I think that's the important language here, shall be imposed or applied by any state or a political subdivision in a manner abridging the right of any citizen to vote on account of race or color. And then in brackets here, you'll see I've added a member of a language minority group. That was another addition resulting from congressional amendments to the Voting Rights Act. So there's Section 2, which applies nationwide. Section 5 is a different animal. and is very unusual, at least as far as federal law is concerned. Jurisdictions that are covered by Section 5 have to seek pre-approval from the Department of Justice or the U.S. District Court for the District of Columbia for any election law changes to take effect. So federal law approval required, federal legal approval required before any of these changes can take place. Application of Section 5 is much more limited and has to do with jurisdictions that had a significant history of racial discrimination, basically the Deep South. There are 9 states completely covered, and then there are 7 other states where portions of the state are covered, certain local jurisdictions. It is interpreted to prevent a regressive effect of election law changes on minorities. In other words, whatever election law changes are made cannot place minorities in a worse position than they were before the passage of those laws. Minnesota is not covered by Section 5. Moving back, and you can see I'm moving fairly quickly here, to Section 2 as it is applied today. Again, reviewing, Section 2 is interpreted to prevent denial or abridgment of a citizen's right to vote on the basis of race, color, or membership in a minority language group, and no intent to discriminate is required. It can be enforced by the U.S. Attorney General or any affected person, so that is not a hurdle to enforcement. Typically, challenges under Section 2 claim that a particular district or a set of districts unfairly reduce the voting strength of a minority group, referred to as vote dilution in the vernacular. You'll see the citation here in the middle of this slide. In 1986, the U.S. Supreme Court issued a landmark decision that provided a lot of guidance for Section 2 violations. And there is fundamentally the principle is stated that a violation occurs if a minority group does not have an equal opportunity to participate in the political process and to elect candidates of their choice. So basically, minority groups must be given a fair opportunity to participate in the process. The Gingles Court, as it's referred to, provided a basic 3-part test that plaintiffs have to establish before courts get to a much more detailed analysis of a particular redistricting plan.
And Mr. Bodern, just before you dive into that particular legal case and the 3-part test, I'm probably getting ahead of you, but is there some Minnesota specific history when it comes to Section 2 and this kind of legal argument?
Mr. Chairman, I don't know of any reported opinions that touch upon a challenge, a Section 2 challenge. I think it's been some of the court plans may have not directly referred to it, but taken it into account since that date. And at the end of the PowerPoint presentation here, there's just a little bit of thinking about how it would apply to Minnesota and some of the things to consider. So, and by the way, I have Senator Rest's amendments, if we can have perhaps the page take her the copies of this to her.
Thank you, Mr. Bodern.
So the 3 preconditions that need to be satisfied before a court will take a longer look at a redistricting plan are stated something like this. The minority group at issue must be sufficiently large and compact enough to constitute a majority in a single member district. And that's, you'll hear that referred to frequently in Voting Rights Act discussions, what's known as a majority-minority district. There must be some kind of record to establish that the minority is politically cohesive, tends to vote together. And the third item, in the absence of special circumstances, block voting by the white majority would usually defeat the minority's preferred candidate, and that's described as racially polarized voting. So if a minority group succeeds, and under the 3-part test, a review of the totality of the circumstances is taken on what does the court do. There is a long list of factors, and there is basically a cottage industry in the production of federal district court opinions applying these factors and going into it that I won't go into great detail here on. But I think some of the important factors are whether there's a history of institutionalized discrimination in the jurisdiction, whether, in fact, preferred candidates of a minority group have been elected. And then this is slightly nuanced from the second item, the proportion of offices held by that minority group, members of that minority group, in relation to the proportion of the minority in the population. Item two, when you're looking at preferred candidates, doesn't necessarily mean that a member of that minority group would have to be elected. There would be other candidates, presumably, who could satisfy that requirement. Some of the, just trying to distill a little bit of the jurisprudence on Section 2, there is no absolute right for a minority group to have a proportion of elected officials equal to the proportion of the group in the total population. And this has actually been codified. This was part of the amendments to Section 2, I think in 1982. Senator Dole sponsored this amendment that clarifies nothing in this section establishes a right to have members of a protected class elected in numbers equal to their proportion in the population. So the analysis becomes more and more difficult. It's not a mechanical analysis in many respects. Things to do to avoid problems with Section 2, steps some jurisdictions have taken that have assisted in facing a Section 2 challenges. It's best to think about perhaps what has failed in the face of those challenges first. Multi-member districts, not a problem for Minnesota, but where members of the minority group have been placed in a large multi-member district, that's basically a method of avoiding their influence. Another item would be single-member districts that are racially packed. And that is a term that's thrown around fairly frequently in the jurisprudence. And that's, as it would suggest, where there's a very significant concentration of minority members in one district, and it would allow them, it would allow the election of a preferred candidate in that district, but not others. It would limit the impact of that minority group. And then kind of the opposite of that, the third item here, are single-member districts that are cracked, where the minority group is split into multiple districts to diminish its influence, so it doesn't have significant voting power in any one district. Courts have required the imposition of a majority-minority district if it can be shown the minority group is large, compact, politically cohesive, and has traditionally failed to elect preferred candidates. That's sort of the simple statement here. There are some nuances to it. What exactly constitutes a majority? Is that 50% plus one? How does that work? For example, is it a majority of the voting age population, or is it a majority of the total population? You can imagine how those things might impact the ability of that minority group to elect a preferred candidate. And then would the size of the majority vary depending on the political cohesiveness of the minority? In other words, if there is less political cohesiveness, is a greater, some sort of supermajority required?
It's an arrest.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. What does that mean?
Mr. Chairman, center arrest, I'm not sure. Which term are you referring to?
The size of the majority vary depending on political cohesiveness. Does that mean... let's take the Latino population, and is political cohesiveness, would that make a distinction between groups that are from South America as opposed to whose origins were in South America as opposed to those who were from Central America or Mexico? Would that... Is that what they're talking about?
Or? Mr. Chairman, Senator Rest, no, it refers to, and I mean, I think you raise another issue, exactly how you're going to define what the minority group in particular is. It refers to the tendency of that minority group to vote cohesively. That's, I think, what is meant by political cohesiveness.
I mean, as a block.
They're correct.
Okay. All right. I see.
And again, it's sort of an inverse relationship. Some courts have looked at this and said the less cohesive the group is, the larger the size of the majority would need to be in order to accommodate their interests. So again, this is sort of a very recent U.S. Supreme Court opinion that cleared up an issue that had been lingering for quite a while. And it's a fairly definitive statement. In 2009, in the Bartlett v. Strickland case, the U.S. Supreme Court said that Section 2 doesn't require the creation of a district where a minority population has a fair chance to win unless the minority will constitute a majority of the voting age population in the district. In other words, if you can't show that such a district could be created, Section 2 would not require it. The second case that I've highlighted for you here on this slide is slightly older. I think it's arguably still a good law, and this relates to the political cohesiveness question and some other factors. A supermajority of 65% has been found necessary in some instances where there are other factors like lower voter registration and lower voter turnout for the particular members of that minority group. In other words, if you don't adjust it to some number, perhaps greater than 60%, it would be unlikely to have the intended effect. So there are some things that can be done to minimize the likelihood of a successful challenge under Section 2. And these are called effective minority districts. They're not required under the Voting Rights Act, but they have been employed to minimize the risk of violations. And these are some of the terms used to describe them. There's a crossover district where the minority group might be able to elect a preferred candidate if it persuades enough members of the majority to elect that candidate. And I might back up a step and say I think some of these are particularly relevant to the demographics in Minnesota. Another type of effective minority district would be what's called an influence district, where the minority group doesn't have a working majority but can exert considerable influence over the elected official through its electoral power. A third type would be a coalitional district, and this is one that's been looked at a fair amount in analyzing minority group demographics in Minnesota, where members of more than one minority group could form a coalition and elect their preferred candidates. So, moving ahead here to the Voting Rights Act and Minnesota, the most recent example of redistricting that took this into account was the Minnesota Supreme Court is the Supreme Court Special Redistricting Panel. And if you look at the demographics there, there were zero majority-minority senator congressional districts. There were six minority opportunity Senate districts based on total population. And I think that's roughly crossing about a 30% threshold for the demographics for the minority in that district. And then, interestingly enough, if you combined all minority groups, there were three majority-minority Senate districts. In that sort of more the looser sense of that term. And there was one absolute majority-minority House district based on total population. However, if you took voting age population into account, it is not a majority-minority district.
Senator Rust.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Potter, and where were those three Senate districts, and where was the one House district?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Rest, I'm going to have to get back to you after the hearing. I have it somewhere in this binder, but I can't remember exactly where I put it.
And
I'm
assuming it's Minneapolis and St. Paul, but may not have been.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Rest, I think that's correct.
But 58
and I think you could safely assume that Senate
Minneapolis
district,
but I don't know where it is, I guess.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Rest, I believe that's correct. That Senate District 58 is in Minneapolis. So moving to the bottom of the slide, there were 11 minority opportunity House districts, again, based on total population, and six majority-minority corresponding to that Senate number if all minority groups were aggregated. And bringing it forward to the 2010 census changes and the impact that census will have, we're getting into the area of the slides here where perhaps Mr. Gillespie would be much more qualified to tell you about some of this, but just kind of leaving a few thoughts with you. I think it's a reasonably fair statement to say that the changes in demographics show that, on the whole, members of particular political parties may have packed themselves in certain areas of the state. And this may not be completely accurate. What's happened with members of minority group populations could perhaps be called fracturing their distribution. I think the numbers remain roughly the same in some of the core districts, but the point is there are larger numbers of minorities in other districts around the state. And if you apply the 2010 census data to current district boundaries, there would be two congressional districts that could be considered minority opportunity districts. Again, that's about the 30% threshold, and I think that would be aggregating minorities. And 8 state senate districts that would be considered minority opportunity districts. So you can see those numbers have increased. And that brings me to the opportunity for questions or any further discussion.
Mr. Bonner, maybe one more time for me. So applying the census data, okay, so you're applying it to our current map. That's all you have to apply it to right now.
That's correct, Mr.
Chairman. So we go from 6 minority opportunity districts in the state senate to 8. Again, using the current map. And we go from 0, am I right, 0 congressional to 2?
I believe that's correct, yes.
And
looking back
would,
at the 2002 slide.
St. Paul, Minneapolis, 4 and 5. Okay. Members, questions for Mr. Bodern on the Voting Rights Act? Good job, Mr. Bonner.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
I know Senator Rest wanted to take the opportunity to talk a little bit more about the principles, and I don't know if you want to, and an addition to the principles, I think is how you describe it.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Not much to say more about the principles other than they've been introduced and not formally heard here, but one thing that was pointed out to me is that in the past, I guess beginning in 2002, we stopped having to vote on language and instead voted on a reference to the map submitted to the GIS office. And the reason for that was in the 1990 redistricting, there were just, it was plain language, supposedly, but it was just dozens and dozens of errors because they didn't get, you know, the name of the street right or a number or something or other. And so to avoid that, what we've done is to adopt a map, and this amendment would just be on top of that resolution. And I think the last time the redistricting principles ended up not being agreed to by the House and the Senate, but there was adopted, and it might have been just in session law or something, but there was adopted how the data was to be used so that we did not run into the problem of errors in language. And instead, the GIS director, who, as you know, is a bipartisan or nonpartisan person, that whatever plan it is that we would be voting on would be, you'd only have to reference the map. And that seems reasonable because we assume that the maps are going to accurately reflect whatever plan it is that or plans that we bring forward. So one way or the other, we want to make sure that we're not forced to do language because we fail to act, and we need to do maps, reference to maps. So it's just, and this is a boilerplate language, and the reason why it's not indicated as new language is because it's an amendment to a resolution, and so we don't, you know, we don't strike anything or add anything. It's just printed. So just for your consideration, if when we might take up how that's going to be accomplished.
Thank you, Senator Rust. So is this literally, Senator Rust or Mr. Byron, the same language that was used 10 years ago?
Yes, it is.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Nothing new.
So the point being, we don't want some thick bill.
Where you're trying to read a description of your district, Mr. Chairman, and you say, well, wait a minute, that boundary is not in Edina. Where is that? And you recognize it as a mistake. But what we don't want is, in my opinion at least, is coming to the floor of the House or the Senate and having to have huge amendments to language that purports to be corrective that might then arouse skepticism among some members about whether it's a correction or whether it's something more than a correction. I mean, a technical correction as opposed to something that's more than that. So, think we should be thinking about that and how to go about doing it, and this is what was done before.
Senator Caldwell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And maybe to Mr. Bodden or perhaps to Senator Rest, obviously I think the map is the superior way to go to avoid the need for corrections. But would you need an amendment, or couldn't the bill just reference, I mean, is there another way to accomplish this as well, or is a Senate resolution the only way, could the bill just be drafted to reference a map?
I have considered three different methods of putting forward redistricting principles that all parties could be guided by. One was, you can put it in statute if you want. That seemed to be more difficult, and a joint resolution, which same language introduced in the House and the Senate, both of those would need to be signed by the governor. A concurrent resolution in this instance would be starting in the Senate, and there is no House version. It would start here. If we passed it, then it would just be sent to the House for them to act on or not. And concurrent resolutions don't need to be signed off on by the governor. And although a plan later on would need to be signed by the governor if it was to have effect, it seemed like to me putting forward the plan seemed better to limit it to the legislature itself without submitting it to the governor. And just to me said, acknowledge the separation of powers, quite frankly, and that this is our job. And so a concurrent resolution accomplished that. And that, I don't have any copies of that, but that got introduced, and it's the principles that were used before, with the exception of competitiveness and setting priorities among the Supreme Court didn't use competitiveness, but they talked about it. That was the issue that divided the House and the Senate at the time, and setting in place priorities for the principles. And I decided that that might be controversial. And the point of having them is to have kind of plain vanilla, not partisan, either favoring Democrats or Republicans. Although, and this is longer than I thought I would talk about this, but
you're on a roll.
Last in the last meeting, Mr. Watson pointed out that generally it is not unusual for the minority, which would be us, to propose redistricting principles and for the majority to resist them. But then he went on to indicate that the if a plan goes to court and the courts can draw whatever plans they want and they don't have to pay any attention to us whatsoever, but that you might have a stronger case for your plan, whether it would be Republican plan, Democratic plan, or quite frankly, a bipartisan plan, that if the courts would look at that, if it was challenged, and see that the degree to which some overriding principles were being applied rather than just here and there, and we don't know what they were doing because it's not evident in the and how well you did it. I just think it's a better place for all of us to be. And I don't, even though Mr. Watson said that the minority offers it, that wasn't the case 10 years ago necessarily. It was that the House and the Senate couldn't agree. And at that time, the Senate was DFL, but the House in 2000
was Republican.
Yeah, it was Republican. So there might have been,
sure,
certainly, you know, some back and forth on that where it couldn't be agreed upon. But the Senate did pass them, as I understand. And I don't know, but I'm not aware that it was particularly one-sided vote, but I'd have to check on that. Anyway, that's...
Mr. Chair, Senator Rest, no bill was ever sent to Governor Ventura either. Is that right?
That's true. Mm-hmm.
And Senator Koch, my sense in some early conversations with the House is I'm not sure there was... I'm not sure that Senator Rest has sold them yet on principles or these principles, but it's... I think we should take another look at them.
Mr. Chairman, because it's a concurrent resolution, we don't have to sell them.
Oh, I understand that.
We can just pass it as a sense of the Senate.
I understand.
Send it to them, and if they don't like them, Representative Anderson doesn't have to take them up.
I thought you were making some progress with Representative Murphy a couple weeks ago.
Well...
But, you know, and the particular language that Senator Rest has handed out today makes, it just makes sense from a, yep. How do you run the debate and the paperwork? I can't imagine what, so maybe back in the 90s or the 80s, what the bill must have looked like, describing 201 separate districts and the thickness of it, and how could anyone ever even understand it? So... I think we have the technology now where things will be much more understandable and transparent, and this would help with that. So let me just ask if there are any members of the audience today that wanted to talk, to testify on the Voting Rights Act. That is what we had Mr. Bodern talk to us about. If not, members, any other comments or discussions? Senator Harrington.
Yeah, Mr. Chair. I know there are some members of the audience, but I will admit that some of my constituency, especially the Somali, Latino, and Hmong community, are really interested in starting to be involved in this discussion. And so I'm wondering how you propose that they would be have their voice other than me as their lone representative maybe speaking. I don't speak that many languages, so it would be useful, I think, to perhaps bring them into the conversation sooner rather than later.
I agree. And there may be other members with some thoughts here, but if you wanted to somehow organize, I mean, as you said, there's multiple groups there, and want to be sensitive to not assuming that any one group speaks for the whole.
You need to go learn all those languages and report back to us quickly.
I'm working on the Hmong right now.
I know he is.
So the Somali I got a little more problem with. So if each of you would take one of them, I would be, I'll take the Hmong. And, do I have a volunteer for Farsi? I guess is the question. So,
Senator Harrington, are you learning green Hmong or white Hmong?
Currently white Hmong. So.
But I think
no, I knew the difference, did you?
No, I'm impressed because most people don't. So
you knew the question.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
But it's absolutely pertinent, Senator Harrington, to a little of the PowerPoint we had today, and again, how do people want to interface with us? And if it sounds like you're at least willing to take the lead to try to make something like that happen, we can work with staff and.
I'm definitely willing to take the lead. I just looking as the most junior person in this room, I'm looking for some direction as to how that happens in the past or if it's happened in the past and what the committee and you as the chair would be comfortable with in terms of making that happen. So,
well, let's talk about that, Senator Harrington. But, the once every 10 years, I'm not sure there is a lot of precedent. And maybe that's good, right? Maybe that's good. We can
make it up as we go along, I guess.
We can make up the right way to do it. I don't know if Mr. Bodern has any thoughts as to particular groups or particular communities, but
Mr. Chairman, there are there's some of the, I guess they're loosely referred to as a whole as the councils of color. I know they have participated, and specifically there are four of them. That's certainly one avenue, and I believe that's been used in the past. Mm-hmm. I know I can.
Would that be having a hearing and inviting them to come and speak, give us their advice? Is that what you might be suggesting, Senator Harrington?
I certainly, Senator Rest, Mr. Chair, I certainly think that would be a good start. That wouldn't necessarily get you total inclusion because, for example, the Council on Black Minnesotans, while it, I think, purportedly would represent Somali and East Africans, frankly, I'm not sure if the representation on their council is really reflective of that particular segment. And I know, as you mentioned, the differentiation between white Hmong, green Hmong, we have Cambodian, Laotian, Vietnamese. The range of Asian Americans is broader than any one community group, I think, would bring. So that certainly would be a good start, but I'm not sure if it would complete the picture necessarily.
Well, let's continue to explore that, Senator Harrington, and we could try to identify the right people to reach out to and see if and when they want to, how they want to interact with us.
And if I could bring up just one other side point to that, which is perhaps not in my purview as sort of the urban representative on the DFL side, but and I don't have necessarily the contacts, so I would need to reach out to others. Because it's not just an urban area. When I go to Wilmer, when I go down up to Duluth, when I, it's really a statewide issue. And so,
Chester.
Chester.
Rochester.
Oh, Rochester. Thank you. I was thinking. I didn't know where Chester was. So.
Oh no, Rochester.
So.
Yeah. Thank you.
So that's another piece of this that I think we also need to look at is beyond the metro area. I think we also need to look at the outstate Minnesota also to make sure that their voices are also heard as we start making these maps up. So.
Very good.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Sandrum.
He is right. The and the challenge to get to them, them is. Certainly not impossible, but it is a challenge. But Rochester is 30% minority now in the last census, so you don't think of Rochester perhaps in its tradition of being that, but there is a reality here. Times have changed, and we need to reach out.
Right. Senator Sandrum, did you go to there was a meeting down in Rochester, was it last month?
Mr. Chair,
if you attended,
And then I wanted to, was there, how did that conversation go? If you didn't, we can.
Mr. Chair, there was a meeting. The House committee was there. I did attend. It probably an hour's worth of a fair amount of testimony came forward. Thinking about it, there was not representation from minority community.
Strikes me, getting back to Senator Harrington's point, it's one thing to talk about or even go there. We've got to make sure we're connecting with the right people in the right way, right?
Mr. Chair, we probably have to even do some education in advance if we really wanted to make that work. Mm-hmm. You know, what is redistricting? Why do we do it? Mm-hmm. Why is it important to you?
Good. All right, members, committee's adjourned.
So
in education?
Yeah. Oh, just